You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Expect plenty of sun today with highs in the lower 80s. Tonight turns mostly cloudy, and a few showers and thunderstorms may show up late, along with some patchy fog by daybreak. Saturday looks unsettled with off and on showers and thunderstorms and highs in the upper 70s. Rain becomes more isolated Saturday night. Sunday brings partly sunny weather with just a slight risk of a shower or thunderstorm and highs in the lower 70s. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Today I'm going solo. I'm recording this in Arroyo Seco, New Mexico, which is about 12 miles outside of Taos, going north toward Colorado. I just returned last night from a 22-hour trip, leaving Paris at 7 o'clock in the morning, arriving here around 8 p.m. last night. So what I would like to do now is narrate that trip for you. And the reason I'm interested in narrating the trip, experimenting, if you will, a few years ago at the Basalt Library, which is in Colorado, not too far from Carbondale, Colorado, I taught a storytelling workshop with a collaborator, Rosemary Watola Trommer. And when we gathered everybody in the library, it was a Saturday, people weren't sure exactly how they wanted to go about telling their stories. And I came up with the idea of demonstrating to people how easy it is to tell a story if you stay connected to the environment that you're working in, the places where you've been, the reality of what's going on. So I proposed that everybody prepare a story that would tell the rest of us exactly what happened to them from the time they woke up, got ready, got dressed, brushed their teeth, had their bagel, drank their coffee, whatever they did, and drove to the library for the workshop. Of course, the basic story is fairly simple. I woke up, I got dressed, I ate breakfast, brushed my teeth, got in my car, drove to the library, walked through the door, sat down, here I am. Nobody had a story like that. When people prepared their story and they told the story of what they did from the time they woke up until the time they arrived at the workshop, the stories were dramatically different. One person said, oh, I stopped and along the way and I looked at the river and I thought about my sister in another country. Another person told the story about having to turn around and go back because they left something behind. Somebody else stopped in the restaurant and bumped into a friend, and the friend told a story about somebody being in trouble somewhere along the way. So by the time everyone finished their five-minute stories, after they had developed these simple stories, they were all quite surprised to find a lot of drama, a lot of tension, a little bit of a cliffhanger because a few people had some secrets they didn't want to tell, and they put those in the story, or at least they hinted at the secrets. So I walked away from that workshop that day thinking, you know, when you write your stories, when you tell your stories, if you can keep them grounded in real life situations and also provide images, movement, emotional turns, and some insight, some kind of revelation, if you will, if you're lucky, then your story will hold together, even if it's a story about getting up and going to the library to take a workshop. The reason why is because we naturally, as human beings, create dramatic tension as we move along. We create questions in our minds. We do things that are unexpected. You know full well life is dramatically improvisational. You can't know what's going to happen next. Neither can I. It's improvisational, that's for sure. And the other thing that's certain, we always are able to deal with whatever happens. It may be clumsy, it may be smart, it may be quick, it may be slow. Whatever happens, it's never happened before. It's definitely spontaneous. And we deal with it. We work with it. That's why when you are thinking about writing your stories, writing your essays, whatever it is you want to write or tell, if you discount that ability that's built into your existence, the ability to respond in the moment to whatever is happening in the now, when you discount that, you are doing yourself a disservice. So what I would like to do now is take something really simple, like the story of me brushing my teeth in Paris, leaving the door and traveling the 22 hours to Taos. I'm not sure exactly how this story will unfold. Even though I lived it, my memory of it will be different than the actual truth of it. The truth is, yesterday I was in Paris. Today I'm sitting here at this table in Arroyo Seco recording this on my MacBook Air with my Hollyland microphone draped across a Monfrotto mic stand, which also serves as a little camera stand when I don't have the mic draped across it. So here's my story of what happened between Paris and Taos yesterday. So I'll back up a little bit from yesterday and begin a couple of days prior. I was booked on the Delta flight, flying out of Paris, going to Salt Lake City, and I was online checking in when I realized that I had only 1 hour between my arrival in Salt Lake City and catching the flight to Albuquerque, where I would then drive north to Taos. Now, I wasn't that worried about it because I knew there were other flights leaving Salt Lake City, headed to Albuquerque later in the day, but I really did want to catch that flight. So I was also concerned that I might have to pay more money if I had to catch a second flight. I also was concerned that maybe I wouldn't be able to catch the flights out of Salt Lake City because they would be full. I'd have to wait overnight. I've spent the night in the airport a few times. It's not that much fun. You can manage it, but you've probably done it before. If you have, you know what I mean. I already had all of my passport information in the Delta app, so most of the information was there, but I was worried about that 1 hour. So I called the airlines up and asked if I could change my ticket. The fellow said, sure, you can change your ticket, but it'll be $140. He said, I wouldn't recommend it. The Salt Lake City airport's fairly easy. You should have enough time to make it through immigration and get yourself to the gate, and off you go to Albuquerque. So I decided that that's the strategy that I would use. I also was a little uncertain about the trip from Paris by train to Charles de Gaulle. Now, I shouldn't be uncertain about that trip. I have made it many, many times. I've been going to Paris to visit my good friend John Van Hasselt for the last over 30 years, taken the same route back to the airport. And yet, I worry a little bit because I never know whether things will change or not. One thing for sure that has changed over the years, I now have access, as you do, to AI, artificial intelligence. I use ChatGPT. Many people use Claude, Gemini, and it is true, ChatGPT can hallucinate. ChatGPT is not very good at generating original text. ChatGPT can give you really terrible advice if you don't know how to ask the right questions. It's not the solution to all problems. ChatGPT, however, is a pretty good solution to travel questions. Not because it knows anything, mostly it searches the internet, gets the information, delivers it back to you in a really smooth form. So what I did, I asked ChatGPT first, what about Salt Lake City? Report came back. Immigration is easy. It's one of the smoothest international airports in the country. You can go through fairly easy. You probably don't have anything to worry about if you haven't checked your luggage. Fortunately, I travel light. I had a carry-on, small carry-on. Maybe surprising to you, but you know, most of the stuff that I pack over the years, and this may be true for you too, most of that stuff that I pack, I don't use, and I wonder why in the world I lugged it around. And I'm not that big a fan of waiting for the luggage, because that also makes me nervous. Well, did they lose my bag? What's going to happen now? So I just take a carry-on, if at all possible. So I had the carry-on. Everything was pretty good there, actually. And I also had a little Scotty vest. Scotty Vest is a company that I've bought a few things from over the years. And the reason I like Scotty Vest is because they have apparel that has many pockets. So this vest had 20 some odd pockets. Of course, the problem with the vest is you can lose your stuff in the pockets and forget where it is. That said, it's secure, it's easy, and it's something that's good to travel with. So I had my wallet, my passport, my keys, everything in the Scotty vest, the carry-on, and then one little bag that had my computer in it. So I was in pretty good shape in that respect. So the report from ChatGPT was, if you are in that kind of position, you likely will be able to make it through. A little tight, still, there's a lot of hope there. My second question was, how do I make sure that I get the right ticket to go to the airport? Well, there's a new system in Paris called Navigo. You buy the ticket from the counter, or I think you might be able to get it from the machine as well. And once you get your Navigo pass, you can just fill it up with the different rides. So that was fairly simple. I got a Navigo pass. I was able to fill it up for the ride to the airport, $14.35, something like that, or 14 euro and 35 cents, which would be a bit more in American dollars. And I knew that whatever station I entered, once I got into the station, as long as I stayed underground, I wouldn't have to worry about being admitted to the train that travels to the airport. Now, one of the things about the train is that if you don't watch the signs, you might make the mistake of getting on the wrong train, even though the train to the airport and other trains also arrive on the same track. Of course, I knew how to do that. So I had everything in order, and ChatGPT, being the good travel guide that I've discovered it to be, advise me, please make sure that you check the train sign as it's approaching the station. And if it says to the airport, then you're in good shape. If it doesn't, don't get on the thing. So prior to my departure yesterday, I'd organized all of that. I sometimes can be a bit cavalier about organizing. I'll figure it out when I get there, I think. Report from the field, bad idea. Every time I've ever tried to figure it out when I got there, the only thing that I figured out was stress. It's a little bit like they say about Las Vegas. Whatever happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. The only thing that stays in Vegas is your money. The rest of it comes home, even if you keep it secret. And as we're playing it by ear in the moment without planning, stress is what stays with you, and it comes home with you as well. So this time, I didn't have much stress. I knew what was going to happen, and I was prepared, ready to go. So yesterday morning, around 5:45, I woke up naturally. I had my bags packed. Everything was ready to go. I only had to say goodbye to John and Sylvie. Sylvie had been on a trip, so she had just returned the night before, so there was a lot of coming and going in the household. So I got up, made a coffee, made a little bit of oatmeal, put some jelly in the oatmeal that I bought last night, tossed a couple of apples into my bag, packed everything, did the idiot search, looking around the room to see if I'd left anything behind. And I was confident that I had gotten everything. And I said goodbye to John and Sylvie, and out the door I went, and I took the elevator down and stepped out onto the street. I checked my Scotty vest pockets, and lo and behold, I had forgotten my iPhone. I'd left the iPhone behind. So I had to ask somebody on the street to let me back into the house, or into the building, go up to the second floor, go back, grab my iPhone. Thank goodness I remembered it when I did. Put it back in my pocket and took the elevator back down, opened the door, and walked out onto Rue de Seille and headed toward the Grenelle metro stop where it was about a 7-minute walk to the Grenelle train station where I caught the train to the Sorbonne stop, which led me to the RER train to the airport. Pretty simple, straightforward, no glitches, no problem. The only thing that I had to deal with was the longer walks, and that wasn't so bad as long as I took my time, paced myself, and the steps were a little steep, so I had to carry my suitcase down the steps. Worked a little bit on that, but still no problems, very smooth. One note here, a lot of people will ask me about how I'm able to travel so much, and I will tell them that I actually am not a traveler, I'm a relocator. I go to Paris to see my friend John. I go to Manila for the winter to be with my partner, Tish. And I spend the rest of the time either in Taos or in Asheville. I'm a relocator. You'll find me in the same coffee shops once I get to the places that I've been going to for years. So I arrived at the airport, Terminal 2. Have to get off at Terminal 2. The train stops there, terminates there at Terminal 2. Not Terminal 1 or Terminal 3, Terminal 2. Terminal 2 is the home base for Air France, which is also a partner of Delta. So that's why I went to Terminal 2. It was fairly easy. I had already checked in. I had everything in order. I printed my boarding passes. I like to print the boarding passes rather than have them on my iPhone. And the reason why, the iPhone might lose its battery power. Something could happen. The printed boarding pass, pretty solid. You got it in your pocket. When you get to the gate, you put it on the machine and they say, "Welcome aboard." And that's exactly what happened. I managed to get to the airport 2 hours before my flight. I hung out a bit. Looked at the shopping, lots of upscale shopping. I didn't buy any expensive bags, no Tumi sacks. I bought a sandwich using the change that I had in my pocket. So I kind of bugged the woman at the counter. I had my €8, which I paid for the sandwich, all counted out in different coins. But she was gracious enough. She counted it, handed me my sandwich, and I went to the gate, hung out. They called my flight. Zoned 5. I had to wait a while to go on to the flight because I was not riding comfort. I was riding back there in the coach section. I was still a little worried about the departure time because I definitely wanted to make the flight exchange that was within that hour frame. And the reason why was because I knew that after I arrived at Albuquerque, I still had a 3-hour drive north from Albuquerque to Taos. At the end of a long haul like that, can be a little bit daunting. I was hoping for good weather, clear skies, that sort of thing, and certainly hoping my battery would start after 3 weeks sitting in the airport parking lot. So there I was on my seat. And then I asked the attendant, I said, could I move forward a little bit because I do have this short time frame in St. Louis. So the attendant said, yeah, you can move forward. Took me up about 6 or 7 seats forward, and I sat in the coach section just behind the comfort. As it turned out, my coach seat just behind the comfort section had a little bit more leg room. Lucky me. So I settled down, buckled up my seat belt, got ready for the 10-hour ride. I looked to my right, and there was a woman 2 seats over, very happy because we had empty seats between us. So not only did I have a little more leg room, I had some more elbow room too, which was always good when you're taking those long haul flights. So I looked to my left and I noticed a couple sitting right across from me. And for some reason, I got a strange vibe from the two of them. And I don't really know why. Could be my projection. Most of the time, the strange vibes that I get from people, I have to assume often are actually not from them, but from my projections, whatever they are. That said, sometimes those vibes have an accuracy. One person was an ordinary-looking character. She was maybe in her 50s. The other part of the couple was a character that was quite stylized. Big watch, sharp cut hair, stuck up a bit, face was without too many whiskers, very smooth face. And there was something about that person that seemed quite controlling. And I let it go. Flight took off. Everything was cool. We sailed out across the territories and you go north, actually, over Dublin, and you cross the pole, or actually over Greenland, and then you come down through Canada heading to Salt Lake City. So it's not across the Atlantic. And I used to think the flights are always across the Atlantic. It took me a while to realize that's not actually how they route those planes. So as the flight moved along, I was streaming a video. I downloaded Homeland, starring Claire Danes. On these long flights, I used to pretend like I was going to do some work, create something significant. But lately on these long trips, I've realized getting work done is rather difficult because it affects my concentration. Something about being in the airplane, I've often thought, I know this is a little bit in the mystical realms, that as I'm flying those long distances, a part of my energetic self gets left behind in the air, and it has to catch up with me. It takes a few days for it to find me again. I know that's a bit fanciful. It's a bit of a poetic leap, but hey, I kind of like the idea. I do feel less motivated on the airplane. I'll give it that. I know other people that can work all the time on the airplanes. I'm not one of those. So I was streaming homeland, eating airline food, sipping a little bit of coffee. They say you're not supposed to be drinking the coffee on the airplane, but I do it anyway. I'm just there, invisible. Nobody notices me. It's fantastic, actually, just to sit in the seat and let that time go by. Meanwhile, the two characters next to me were having a grand old time. I noticed that the more stylized member of the pair seemed to be controlling the other one. Now, again, projection, I don't know, but they were reading from the same tablets. They were moving in similar ways. Maybe they were just synchronized and there was no manipulation going on at all. And then I noticed something I've never, ever, ever seen before. And you may have seen this on a flight. I've never seen it. I looked over and the stylized partner was watching a video. And I looked over to the other member of the troupe and she was also watching a video. They were watching the same video. Okay, fine. Maybe they're kind of sharing a movie, but they were making sure that the video was synchronized so that they were both watching almost at exactly the same time. Now, I couldn't tell if that was strange, weird, inspired, or what, but I couldn't take my attention away from it. I thought, my goodness, people would go to that length to do that. I wonder what's going on with those two. Now, again, I felt a strange vibe from the more stylized one. I'm not sure exactly what was going on there. Probably nothing. Everything that was going on inside of me, not with them. They seemed to be having a rather good time, and they seemed to be in complete accord, agreeing on everything they did. So maybe just a couple headed back from Paris after a week or two in the city of love, the city of lights, the Eiffel Tower, the Notre Dame, the Pont des Arts, Pont Neuf, the River Seine, all of those places located, those tourist places. And I'm as much a tourist as anybody. And in fact, I was able to be a bit of a tourist when I was there. I enjoy walking around Paris. Been there a lot, but I do enjoy the place. So as I'm sitting on the airplane, I'm thinking about, you know, being in the city, thinking about spending the 10 days with my friend John. John is struggling with some health issues right now, and I volunteered to take 10 days with him to be his caregiver while his wife went away on vacation. So it was not a time to go to the cafe and sip coffee and talk about politics and dream about art. It was a time when two old friends spent some time together, maybe last days. Who knows? Time ticks, time moves. I always turn to that line that T.S. Eliot wrote, time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future. And time future contained in time past. So there I was, cooking food, going shopping, occasionally getting a coffee at the local cafe. Nothing dazzling about it. I did go out a bit and photograph some of the advertising signs in the metro. And I had an occasion to meet a few people that I enjoyed meeting, old friends. Susan Loomis is a chef in Paris. She has a cooking school en route à 10, Susan Loomis, Paris. If you're interested in some really cool stuff on Instagram, you can find her and look at her Instagram. I met a couple of people who are writing and one woman who was conducting a writer's workshop, Toto Santos in Paris. Her name is Jay. And Jay and I spent a couple of hours talking. And Jay was once the editor for the Paris Review. She's also a professional editor now and has worked for many magazines over the years, has been a resident of Brooklyn for a long time, and she told me during the visit that she's planning on moving out of Brooklyn. She sold her place, and she's going somewhere else. Maybe, she said, maybe I'll come to Paris. So we had a great rendezvous, a great time together. So it wasn't all about taking care of John, but as I'm sitting there on the plane across from this couple that I still haven't figured out yet, I'm just reflecting on all of those times there. And one of the things that was happening on the last few days while I was in Paris, a dramatic heat wave hit France and England. Above 93 degrees, summertime, summer heat. If you live in Florida, you know what that feels like. I go to Manila a lot, and the Manila temperature is often above 90 degrees. Certainly 90 degrees in the southeast during the summertime. Not so much in France, but it was yesterday when I left and the day before, and I looked at the weather map, and sure enough, it's going to be 90 degrees plus for the next two or three days. So it was hot in Paris. And the Parisians don't have much air conditioning, so when those kind of heat waves hit, they notice it inside, especially after two or three days, the place heats up. Anyway, I left John's apartment. I left Sylvie. They're dealing with the heat. I think they'll be fine. They've done it before. They'll be able to do it again. Sitting there on the plane, looking at my odd couple to the left, binging my Homeland series on my iPhone with my earbuds. What better thing to do to pass the time, really? At least for me. So we flew, and I nodded off a bit, and we continued on. The woman next to me in the seats that we shared, she stretched out. She had a nap. I got up, did a few yoga stretches. I had some pain in my back, some soreness, and it seemed to not go away, so I had to deal with that. And 10 hours passed. I look up. Suddenly, ladies and gentlemen, we are now approaching the Salt Lake City Airport. We're on approach. Prepare your seats. Raise your seats up. Buckle your seat belts. We're going to go through the cabin one more time to collect the trash. Get ready to land. So I'm ready to land. And I planned to open up my mobile entry app, which I downloaded in Paris. ChatGPT told me if I wanted to really speed things up, download the mobile entry app and put the passport information in. And once you do that, all you have to do is have the app take your picture while you're sitting in the airplane and declare nothing. And of course, since I had no checked baggage, I was thinking, well, maybe I can make it. Sure enough, this airplane landed at 1:40 p.m., exactly the time they said they would land. Now, that's quite a distance to know exactly what time you're going to land. They managed to get it just right, and I was grateful for that. It was a clear day in Salt Lake City. I've not spent much time in Salt Lake City. I have been through that airport a few times, and I will say the Salt Lake City airport is quite nice. Very clean, very smooth, dramatically well organized. Everybody's friendly. No problem at all with that. So the plane lands and it rolls up to the gate. Oh, I must say that one of the things in Paris, the plane didn't roll. There was no plane at the gate. When we boarded, we had to get on this bus and ride this crowded bus for about 20 minutes before we got to the plane and then walked up the steep steps to get on the airplane. So the Paris departure was a little rough. I left that out. But it was really, really, I don't know if it was fun or not, but you know, if you like being a sardine, then take the bus from the gate to the airplane in Paris. Meanwhile, unlike Charles de Gaulle, Salt Lake City Airport was very smooth. You just rolled up to the gate, connected. I stood up, pulled my bag off the top, and got ready to go. Well, to my surprise, the plane emptied rather easily. No problem. I thought, well, this is encouraging. So I got off and I started following the signs to immigration. Now, we've been told on the airplane, you have to collect your checked bags before you go into immigration. So I knew I was way ahead of the game. I had my mobile entry done, no checked bag. I was getting out ahead of the crowd, ahead of the herd. I was one of the members of the herd. And off I went. Everybody was gathered around the luggage area. I just zipped past, and I managed to get to immigration. Well, lo and behold, I spot the line I am supposed to go into, the mobile app line. And I am thinking of all the past experiences I've had with immigration at places like JFK, Atlanta, Manila, Paris, leaving Paris, getting through the lines at immigration. Those lines are usually dramatically long. And as I'm coming toward my line, I'm expecting to see exactly the same thing. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I just have no faith. I am one of no faith. So I get to the line and I look down and there's not a soul in the line. It's just me. A straight shot to the immigration counter. So I walked up to the immigration counter thinking, am I dreaming? Has my little soul that I left behind in the mystical air above Canada catching up with me sooner than I thought? So I walked up to the woman at the counter. And as I said, the people at Salt Lake City are pretty friendly. And this immigration woman was no different. She smiled at me. She said, hello. And I said, hello. I said, I'm trying the mobile app for the first time. And she said, well, let's just see how it works. Let's see how you did. So she plugged me in, took a picture of my face, and she said, well, it passed. You did just fine. Welcome home. And I said, do I get an A? And she says, yes, you get an A for effort. Here you are. And the door swung open, and I was in the terminal. And I did that in 10 minutes or maybe 15 at the most from the time I departed the plane until the time I arrived at the area where I needed to board for my next flight. So I zipped around a bit and arrived at the Albuquerque gate. I think it was gate 38. And there I was. And sure enough, they were loading zone one. So I stood there while they were loading the airplane. And one of the things I like to do when I stand in a line, because I have memorized so many poems, I like to try to remember some of the poems that I have memorized. So while I'm standing there in the Salt Lake City line, getting ready to board the airplane to Albuquerque, I decided I would recite The Highwayman by Alfred Noyes. It's a 7-minute poem. I was looking at the line and I thought, well, it'll probably take me 7 minutes to 10 minutes to get through the line. And I thought, well, I guess I'm probably the only person standing in this line that will be reciting The Highwayman by Alfred Noyes under my breath. So when I recite poetry that I've known to pass the time, I tend to not try to perform it. And what I mean by perform it is get it up to performance level so that it's smooth and easy and everybody can understand everything that's being said. I like instead to just work with each line to get it down. Now, the Highwayman is a story of a highwayman, a bandit living in UK somewhere. And he's in love with this beautiful woman who's the daughter of an innkeeper. And so he tells the woman that he's going to ride off to get some gold. He's going to rob the stage and that he's going to come back at midnight and bring the gold and bring his love and they'll be always together. Meanwhile, the stable hand, Tim, the ostler, he's called, he's in love with Bess, the landlord's daughter. And so Tim turns the highwayman over to the redcoats. And so the story unfolds, Tim turning the highwayman over to the redcoats, and then what ensues. It's a bit of a drama. And so I'm standing there at the gate, getting ready to board, and I'm muttering, the wind was a torrent of darkness among the gusty trees. The moon was a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas. The road was a ribbon of moonlight looping the purple moor, and the highwayman came riding up to the old inn door. Over the cobbles he clattered and clanged in the dark inn yard. He tapped with his whip on the shutters, but all was locked and barred. He whistled a tune to the window, and who should be waiting there but Bess, The landlord's daughter, the landlord's red-lipped daughter, plaiting a dark red love knot into her long black hair. And dark in the dark old inn yard, a stable wicket creaked, where Tim the ostler listened. His face was white and peaked. His eyes were hollows of madness, his hair like moldy hay. But he loved the landlord's daughter, the landlord's red-lipped daughter, dumb as a dog. He listened. He heard the robber say, "One kiss, my bonny sweetheart. I'm after a prize tonight, but I shall be back with the yellow gold before the morning light. Yet if they press me sharply and harry me through the day, I shall come to thee by moonlight, I shall come to thee by midnight, though hell should bar the way." He stood upright in his stirrups. He scarce could reach her hand, but she loosened her hair in the casement. His face burned like a brand as the black cascade of perfume came tumbling over his breast, and he kissed its waves in the moonlight, oh, sweet black waves in the moonlight, and then tugged at his reins in the moonlight and galloped away to the west. So as I'm standing there, getting ready to board my flight to Albuquerque, I'm reciting The Highwayman under my breath. It does pass the time. If you want to take a few moments to memorize some poetry and you find yourself in a long line, you'll have something to do. And it's good fun. I never get tired of that. So I boarded the flight to Albuquerque, buckle my seatbelt, very small flight, still streaming, still binging Homeland. And guess what? The plane was on time. So far, I had had zero problems on this trip. Not a one. Amazing. So they lifted off. Hour and a half flight from Salt Lake City to Albuquerque, New Mexico. We landed on time.
I pulled my bag out of the overhead bin, gathered my other sack, and off I went. I was glad to step back into the Albuquerque airport. If you've been to the Albuquerque airport in the last year or so, you know there's a lot of construction going on there. They've almost finished everything. So when I stepped out, it was a relief just to be back. The journey was over. Actually, it wasn't quite over. I had 3 more hours to go before I got to Taos because I had to pick up my car and drive up the mountain. But in terms of the travel in the air, all the airport stuff, immigration, checking things out, going through the TSA lines, having my bags packed and unpacked, having to drink the water before I go through the TSA line or through the line in Paris. It's not TSA there, but they have a fairly rigorous check in Paris as well. So it was a relief just to come off the plane, sit down, take a breath, and think, okay, I made it back. It was about 4:22 when I stepped off that plane, and I stepped off looking out the windows, and it was, of all things, raining in Albuquerque. In fact, when we pulled up to the gate, the pilot announced we had to take a pause because there was a thunderstorm overhead. It's not uncommon this time of year, thunderstorms in Albuquerque and New Mexico, but there it was, cloudy day, bit of rain coming down. I wheeled my bag out, caught the shuttle to pick up my car. I paid in advance, so I didn't have to worry about anything. The shuttle driver who took me to my car was very good because he said, "Would you like for me to wait because you've been here 3 weeks? Maybe your car won't start." I noticed that in the front of his van, he had this high-octane charger that he had in the front. So you plug it up and it would charge the batteries. I guess a lot of people have batteries running down in the parking lots. Anyway, my battery worked. I pulled out onto the highway and headed north in the rain up to Santa Fe, driving fairly easy. I used to speed a bit more, don't speed much these days. Stayed right under the speed limit, passed a few cops, glad to have stayed under the speed limit, I'll tell you that, and was just listening to some audio and cruising along, watching the world go by, and I was exhausted. Whew, I'll tell you. It's quite a ride. And the drive
wasn't as demanding as you might think, but it was definitely a ride. I was driving a 2013 Toyota Corolla that I bought during COVID for $12,500. It had 13,000 miles on it. Someone had owned it in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and I guess they only drove it around the block, maybe drove it to church on Sunday. It had almost no miles, and now it's a 2013, and it has only 75,000 miles on it. So I was glad to have that little car. I suppose I could have a fancier car if I wanted, but this one is so practical. And one of the things I love about my little Toyota Corolla, it's brown. Ugliest thing you have ever seen. Make a brown bug look beautiful. And nobody recognizes the car. It's about as invisible as you can get. So I am happy to report it rides fine, and I have brand new tires on the car, Michelin tires. I bought them at Jan Davis Tire Center in Asheville. I always like to stop by that place. And also, I've bought tires at Garcia Tires in Taos. So these two tire places have always been good to me, and I'm glad to have some tires on my car. I think having tires on your car is a good thing, because if you don't, well, you know what happens after that. Rain coming down, you might skid off the road. So there's a relief route around Santa Fe. And by the time I made it to the relief route, sometimes that's hard to say, I'm relieved to take the route. My friend Alexandra Weber had sent me a text saying, I have some green chili on the stove for you when you come. And Alexandra and I live in a compound that Allegra Houston owns. It's not really a compound, but it's a series of little rental properties. It's a bit of a creativity laboratory, if you will. And so Alexandra's here and her two dogs, Marley and Luna, her son's around, and other folks. Allegra's son is here, and Janet's across the street. Janet's an editor. She works for Norton, and she gets to edit some pretty serious books. She gets some even secret books. She edited Michael Lewis. She's his editor, if you know Michael Lewis. He wrote The Big Short and other major books. But Janet often edits his books, and so she's quite good. I've learned a lot about editing from Janet. So as I managed to make it up the mountain to Taos, it was still daylight. Popped over the ridge. I could see the big Taos mountain in front of me. Did a dip down through some curves, came back up again. Mountain was still there. See the Rio Grande Gorge to the left. And I took the route around Taos. I didn't go through Taos. I took the route around Blueberry Hill Road and managed to make my way to the drive. Drove in, and Alexandra was there. She served some food. We sat down and had a chat. And that, my friends, was the end of my drive. I did a little bit of an adjustment, chatted a bit, finally fell asleep around 11 o'clock. So when you think about movement and you think about travel and you think about storytelling and how you can put together a story out of almost anything, as you could see, I had no disasters. The biggest worry was getting through immigration in Salt Lake City, and that was the easiest of the whole thing. It was harder actually to pull the overhead bag from the overhead than it was to get through the immigration folks in Salt Lake City. So now let's return for a moment to the Basalt Library and that morning when Rosemary Wattola-Trommer and I were giving that workshop. I just gave you my story of what happened to me when I got up and brushed my teeth in Paris and made my way to the desk where I'm recording this now in Arroyo Seco, New Mexico. I don't think what I told you had any great literary value, no great impact particularly, and yet maybe what my story was able to deliver to you was a sense that you don't have to get really complicated in this business of language, communication, storytelling, and writing. It's all about the delivery system. Right now you're listening to this on the radio or streaming it on a platform. I will take what I've done and I will transcribe it and put it into text. And I will examine the text to see if there's anything in the text that might be worth developing. Stories within the stories within the stories. So the reason why it's important when you write your stories, tell your stories, or record them like I do, and I recommend you practice what I'm doing right now. If you have a smartphone, you can open up the voice memo on the smartphone. The speaker is perfectly fine. Hit record, and by golly, you will end up not only with your story recorded, but if it's under 20 minutes, you'll end up with a transcription of it on the smartphone. And then you can look at the text and see what you think about it. So this is really all about exploring the interior of your imaginative process, the subterranean parts of it. I once went to Carlsbad Caverns years ago and went down into the cavern. And when I say years ago, this was in the early 70s. The cavern's still there. It's been there for a million years. Where would the cavern go? It was full of bats and all kinds of water dripping. And it was big and cavernous. And I often think of Carlsbad Caverns when I think about how powerful our imaginations can be and how deep they can run and how far we can go with them and how interesting it is, especially when you try to keep it simple. So once I got back to Taos and got settled in, I got a good night's sleep. I woke up this morning and looked around and didn't quite know where I was. Well, am I still in Paris? Wait, where am I? Oh my gosh. Ooh, I'm in Taos. It's dawn. It's 5:25. I've already slept. I'm awake. I made a coffee, sat down, gave it a little bit of thought to life, jotted a few notes in the journal, and started my day, which was like any other ordinary day. And along the way, I have been putting this show together. Now, I admit, I recorded half of it earlier today, and then I got a little bit tired, and my attention pulled me to somewhere else. And now I'm back at the desk, finishing up the recording. So my journey is over, but guess what? The highwayman is still riding. I left you hanging. The highwayman tugged at his reins and galloped away to the west. What happens in part two? Well, we have enough time to find out. Let's go to another journey at another time and continue on with the highwayman. The highwayman has kissed the sweet black waves of his love's hair in the moonlight, and he's now tugged at his reins, and he's galloped away to the west. And here's part two. He did not come in the dawning. He did not come at noon. But out of the tawny sunset, before the rise of the moon, when the road was a gypsy's ribbon looping the purple moor, a redcoat troop came marching, marching, marching. King George's men came marching up to the old inn door. They said no word to the landlord. They drank his ale instead, but they gagged his daughter, and they bound her to the foot of her narrow bed. Two of them knelt at her casement with muskets at their side. There was death at every window, and hell at one dark window, for Bess could see through her casement the road that he would ride. They had tied her up to attention with many a sniggering jest. They had bound the musket beside her with the muzzle beneath her breast. Now keep good watch. And they kissed her. She heard the doomed man say, look for me by moonlight, watch for me by moonlight, I'll come to thee by moonlight, though hell should bar the way. She twisted her hands behind her, but all the knots held good. She writhed her hands till her fingers were wet with sweat or blood. They stretched and strained in the darkness. The hours crawled by like years, till now, on the stroke of midnight, cold, on the stroke of midnight, the tip of one finger touched it. The trigger, at least, was hers. The tip of one finger touched it. She strove no more for the rest. Up. She stood up to attention with the muzzle beneath her breast. she would not risk their hearing. She would not strive again, for the road lay bare in the moonlight, blank and bare in the moonlight, and the blood of her veins in the moonlight throbbed to her love's refrain. Trot-a-lot, trot-a-lot. Had they heard it? The horse hoofs ringing clear. Trot-a-lot, trot-a-lot in the distance. Were they deaf that they did not hear? Down the ribbon of moonlight, over the brow of the hill, the highwaymen came riding, riding, riding. The redcoats looked to their priming. She stood up straight and still. Trot-a-lot in the frosty silence. Trot-a-lot in the echoing night. Nearer he came and nearer. Her face was like a light. Her eyes grew wide for a moment. She drew one last deep breath. Then her finger moved in the moonlight. Her musket shattered the moonlight, shattered her breast in the moonlight, and warned him with her death. He turned. He spurred to the west. He did not know who stood bowed with her head o'er the musket, drenched in her own blood. Not till the dawn he heard it. His face grew gray to hear how Bess, the landlord's daughter, the landlord's black-eyed daughter, had watched for her love in the moonlight and died in the darkness there. Back he spurred like a madman shrieking a curse to the sky, with the white road smoking behind him and his rapier brandished high. Blood red were his spurs in the golden noon. Wine red was his velvet coat when they shot him down on the highway, down like a dog on the highway. And he lay in his blood on the highway with a bunch of lace at his throat. And still of a winter's night, they say, when the wind is in the trees, when the moon is a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas, when the road is a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor, a highwayman comes riding, riding, riding. A highwayman comes riding up to the old inn door. Over the cobbles he clatters and clangs. In the dark inn yard, he taps with his whip on the shutters, but all is locked and barred. He whistles a tune to the window, and who should be waiting there but the landlord's black-eyed daughter, Bess. The landlord's daughter, plaiting a dark red love knot into her long black hair. And there you go, my friends. Thus concludes The Highwayman by Alfred Noyes, and brings us around to the last little bit of time we have together. I'm grateful that my trip didn't turn out like The Highwayman's trip. That's definitely a ghost story. I used to perform that poem quite a bit for middle school students, and tried to do it around the Halloween time in October, the creepy time. It is kind of a creepy poem, and it's really sad when you think about it all. Even so, that's the poem that I chose to play around with as I was getting ready to get on the airplane. You never know what will pop up in your imagination when you're on these journeys, or what you'll see, or what you'll do. Leaving Paris, getting on the train, getting on the flight, watching the couple across from me do whatever they were doing. I still don't know. Managed to make it through immigration. Salt Lake City, on to Albuquerque, and now I'm here, finishing up this show, and I hope you did enjoy The Highwayman. I like reciting those poems. I love to just try to bring the memory back and see all the images and do what I can with it and come back the next day and do it again. So I think on that note, I'll come back next week and do something again. For now, though, we've arrived at the end of our time together. Thank you so much for taking this journey with me. I appreciate you tuning in, and I'd love to hear what you think about it. You like these kind of things? If you do, you can send me an email, nave@jamesnave.com. I would really like to know if this kind of stuff works, if you have ideas about what you'd like for me to talk about, suggestions for people you'd like for me to interview. I'm always open for your suggestions and your thoughts, and I'd love to hear from people, so would like to hear from you if you have a chance. You can send me an email, nave@jamesnave.com. So with that, I'll say that you've been listening to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. We aired this show First on Community Radio, WPVM-FM in Asheville. Thank you, Devine Dial, for managing WPVM-FM. We also air it in Taos, Taos, New Mexico, and Alamosa, Colorado, by way of KCEI-FM, Cultural Energy Radio. And Robin Collier, Mike Tilley, thank you for managing that station. I'm grateful to always have opportunities to do community radio stuff. And if you like to write, I host a gathering every Saturday with my creative collaborator, Allegra Houston, and we gather on Zoom. People call from all over the place. Surprising at how many people find us and pop up. We work for an hour. It's a writing workshop. We only write for 10 minutes. We read and we discuss a bit about ideas and things that come up. It's just a delightful group of people, and I've enjoyed it a great deal and would love to invite you to come be with us on the Zoom call. The door's always open. It's free, and we do ask for a little support now and then, but not all that much. And but the door's never closed. You can always come be part of it, and we're grateful for that. So you can go to jamesnave.com and you can find that information. And speaking of information, thank you, Walter Parks, for our theme song, walterparks.com, for more on Walter's music. Walter is a terrific singer-songwriter. I love the way he plays. We've been friends for years and years, and we're working on some projects right now. I'm hoping that Walter will show up and be with us this fall at the Lake Eden reunion. The Leaf Festival has moved to another site, but Lake Eden and Camp Rockmont are still there. So a lot of the folks that have been there for many years are still continuing with the festivities, the celebrations, the jubilations. So we'll be there for that this fall. Maybe Walter will be too. Meanwhile, wherever you are in the world, lean into whatever you're doing. Say hello to somebody along the way, maybe somebody you don't know. Enjoy what you're doing. Commit a little bit to something that maybe you haven't done before. Tell a story about what you did after you brushed your teeth. Once again, thanks ever so much for tuning in. I'm glad you did, and I hope you come back sometime soon. And until then, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
Tuned in to Community Radio, WPVM-LP, Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7, streaming online, WPVMFM.org, the voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Stuart Smith. The US and Iran are very close to agreeing a ceasefire extension, according to US Vice President J.D. Vance. The framework deal would reportedly extend the current ceasefire by 60 days, allow shipping traffic to resume through the Strait of Hormuz, and launch talks on Tehran's nuclear program. The development follows increased hostilities between Tehran and Washington in recent days. Nega Anger is a former senior advisor at the U.S. State Department. She says